Session number 27075, reel 30.
Squadron Leader Leggett, reel 30. So you were displaying your aircraft to the crowd.
Yes, indeed. And there were a couple of RAF officers there. The wing commander was insisting that he take me down to the bar and give me a drink. So I asked these chaps to look after the aeroplane and went down to the bar and had this drink and came back again. And by this time it was time to be going home, I thought. So it was, and started up all right, got the thing going, and went to the utmost extremity of the field, which I could see wasn't all that big, and virtually got it under the hedge, pointed it into the wind, and ran it up to full power and blasted off. And it did get pretty rough towards the end of the run. The aircraft was bouncing up and down a bit. Fortunately, it clung into the air and stayed there and got away all right. But I wouldn't do it again. It was a bit dicey.
Was it a robust aircraft in the Meteor?
Well, yes, it was. But I did inquire when I got back. And I said I've had a bit of a rough ride on this Marshall's airfield. Oh, he said that's all right. He said we'll check out the undercarriage. Sometimes a rough ride does bend things. He said we'll have a look, make sure it's all right. And indeed it was. They couldn't find anything.
I don't think we've said actually on the tape, Graham, which squadron you were with at the time.
Oh, that was...
We said where you are, but not which one.
Oh, yes, this was... Two, three, four. Yeah, I was torn between 234 and 245. I went to 245. Well, I didn't actually go there. At least I didn't fly there. So, yeah, 234. Which undoubtedly has long since disappeared, like so many squadrons have.
What was the character of that squadron? Because you mentioned some of the personnel, obviously the ranks they were holding at that stage.
Yes.
But can you mention some of the personnel and how it was organised in the jet squadron, if there's any difference?
Well, it was all a bit informal, really. We did have a program of exercises which we should do in rotation, so that one kept one's hand in on various aspects instead of just getting up and barnstorming around the sky every time. It was a good idea to have something sensible to do, either a formal aerobatic program where you set yourself an aerobatic program to work through, or a low flying exercise, which of course is always very welcome, or we'd go to the gunnery ranges. We had got to gunnery range up at Dinghy Flats. Would that be North Lincolnshire? Anyway, the gunnery range is at North Lincolnshire. Yeah, we'd go up there. We got that. But it was all rather informal. Johnny Plagius, the squadron commander, Rhodesian, I knew him in Malta. In fact, he was involved in an incident in which a chap was nearly killed. One of the admin officers at Takali was going into the mess up at Mdina and grousing about something. And a pilot who just had a hell of a close shave, walked in behind this chap and heard him moaning about some miserable thing. And he pulled out his revolver and was about to shoot this chap in the back. And Johnny Plagius just happened to be standing there. And he reached over and he put his thumb where the striker had come on the revolver. Tore it out of his hand. Yeah. And we made a hell of a mess of Johnny's thumb too, you can imagine. And he was a very laid up creature. He more or less let us please ourselves what we did. As long as we were around, if we want to go off the station, we did. I'm just say, well, we're buzzing off down to London or whatever. He's quite relaxed about it all. And this was the general shape of things, really. Unless we've got a specific job to do, like the big fly pass, the big victory fly pass, that sort of thing. Otherwise, it was a very relaxed, informal activity. It wasn't a wonderful station. It was only a wooden hutted station, which we were so that meant we were using dormitory huts. Whereas on the permanent stations, of course, everybody had their own rooms by then. And indeed, I was quite glad when they. And I was told I was to go to a 245 squadron at Horsham St Faith, because there were proper merit quarters there, and there was one available, and it was a permanent station with all the proper amenities, proper mess and everything and so on. And I was posted up there. I'd only been there a week, I think, and I'd only done a couple of trips. And the agent sent for me and said, they're looking for experienced admin people for a job at headquarters, Fighter Command Stanhall. How would you feel about that? I said, well, I'm rather keen to carry on flying now, and I'm back on flying after quite a spell of admin. Oh, he said, well, I'll see if I can do what I can do. Anyway, he came back later on and said, I'm sorry, he said, they're being a bit insistent. He said, they're interviewing for this job, and there's half a dozen on the list, and you're one of them, and they want all six to go regardless. So he said, if you can talk your way out of it when you're down there, up to you. Anyway, I got down there to Bentley Priory and went into this group captain Cole, dear old chap, dear old Cole. And he said, "Well, it's a very interesting job. It's here in the next office to mine, organisation department, under Wing Commander Johnny Ironmonger." And he said, I'd rather like you to do the job, he said. So there I was. And so I packed up the family, and we all moved back down to Kingston, Berylands.
Before we move on slightly there, could I just ask you a question there about the... You said you flew in the Victory Flypast.
Oh, no, I didn't. Oh. No. The squadron... That was the sort of job the squadron would be given... A specific job, whereas the rest of the time it was all a bit informal. But of course, for the big fly pass, it was all very formal. And in fact, it took a lot of working up. I did do a fly pass later on in Egypt, and to work up for one takes quite a lot of exercising, practicing to get the timing spot on.
When you were actually with 234, was the did you do any formation flying with
the missiles? Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Is that affected by the speed of the aircraft, or is there anything that you have to be more aware of flying jet rather than, say, a pistol?
No, and this does come as a surprising reply, I suppose, because of the speeds involved. But when you consider the Red Arrows or any other display formation, travelling at a very high rate of knots, and yet their formation is spot on. Now, it takes a lot of practice to do that, of course, but the sheer speed at which you're flying is relative, because you're all doing the same speed, or you should be. And moreover, the engines they have today are so responsive, just a minute movement on the throttle lever, and you can adjust your position in the formation very accurately. I think it's probably easier to fly a high-speed jet in formation than a Tiger Moth. I wouldn't be surprised. No, it's no great problem. And indeed, formation aerobatics, again, a lot of practice required, and certainly the lead aircraft needs to be a very good aerobatic pilot. It's surprising how easy it is to stay in formation at those sort of speeds.
And when you were in the squadron, what was its role? Was it fighter interception, or was it?
Oh, yes, day fighter interceptor squadron, yeah. Our targets in those days would have, of course, been the Russians.
Were the Russians considered a threat that early on, at that stage? Or you?
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed. Not as serious a threat as it became when we got up to the missile business, but I think most of us looked upon Uncle Joe as something of a menace. Was he still with us? When did he go?
Yeah, he would be with you, certainly. I think he was 53 he died.
73, was it?
53. So this is the early period of the war, isn't it? So
that's right. Yeah.
So what was the actual meteor armed with?
Oh, four cannon, 420 millimeter cannon. Well, it got a fair old punch. It was a good aeroplane. It was certainly vastly superior to the Messerschmitt 262, which wasn't all that reliable, I understand. Reliability was good. I can't recall any emergencies arising. No, it was a good aeroplane. The only thing, it was used in Korea, but not very successfully. And I understand that it was the manoeuvrability that was the problem when they were up against the MiGs. I think that was the thing about the Meteor. It would have been all right. It would have been a very good aircraft defending these shores against incoming Soviet bombers. It would have been a good interceptor. I think it had the legs to catch them, and maneuverability wasn't all that important in that type of affair.
Would there have been a problem though intercepting, say, piston engine bombers with a jet aircraft like the Meteor in comparison again with intercepting a piston aircraft with a piston engine aircraft?
Well, no, because the sheer speed advantage, you see, you've got another 100 miles an hour over a piston fighter, which is very considerable, makes a big difference. I'd have been only too delighted to have some Ruskers to poop at.
I was only thinking maybe, is there anything that you have to be aware of? Because you obviously would have a faster closing speed, wouldn't you?
I see what you mean. Oh, yes, you would have to, you'd have to watch on that, all right. Yes, you would close very fast. We used to dogfight with each other. Not quite the same thing, of course, as attacking a bomber. And stupidly enough, I don't know why, it was never arranged. But as far as I can remember, we didn't do any cooperation with bomber units at all. would have made a lot of sense if we had, but certainly not not to my knowledge. It could well be that some squadrons did organise things this way. Maybe it was just that Johnny Plage would sooner be playing golf.
It sounds actually there's a bit of a wind down in the atmosphere.
Oh, very much so. We were all very very keyed up flying these jets because they were a delight to fly. But as far as business was concerned, I think the tendency was to put pleasure first, and business to be done could be dealt with as and when. I think this is the way it was. No doubt it would vary enormously from squadron to squadron, and squadron commanders, I mean, some squadron commanders did everything very much by the book, and there was no slacking or laying about. Others were fairly laid back, as Johnny Plages was.
And can you remember at that time if how your aircraft were camouflaged, or if they were camouflaged? Mm,
all silver, yeah. All silver. Pretty too, yeah.
So that was almost a return to the pre-war days of the silver airframe.
That's right, yes. And some of them used to pretty themselves up too. They'd put squadron markings on, yes. They looked very pretty. There again, we didn't. Yes, John, he was very much a Rhodesian, very, very laid back. We think about that. Yeah.
And what about your other fellow pilots? Did you know any of those other flight lieutenants? I thought you crossed them in your flying career.
No, it never happened that way. Very often it would. Wherever one went normally, there would nearly always be somebody there you knew. I'm just thinking through. No, I can't think there was anybody I'd come across before. Sammy Osborne was my flight commander, and George Mason was the other flight commander. Strudwick and Edelston. Basil Jett, there's a name to conjure with. Basil Jett, yes. it was pleasant enough. The accommodation at Boxted was pretty poor, wooden hut, but it was okay when I got up to Horsham. We got the main quarter, but in the event I hardly moved in, because I was given this job down at Stanmore, and so it was packing up the family and trundling off down, and they went back into mother-in-law's house at Kingston. But it wasn't long before a married quarter became available at Stanmore, which was rather fortunate. There were only three there. We had got quite a few hirings. People could hire a house out, and the Air Force would pay for it if you could make an arrangement. But there were three married quarters, one for a wing commander, one for a squadron leader, and one for a flight lieutenant. And I got the flight lieutenant's house.
What did you get in those types of houses in those days? What would the RAF provide for you when you got a married quarters?
Oh, it would be complete. Or at least it should be. It would be completely furnished. And there were scales. And you'd find these in what were then called King's Regulations and Air Force Instructions. And that was a book that thick. And there would be a full range of furnishings, but all strictly to the schedule. Like, there'd be a three-piece suite and an occasional table. There'd be a dining table. There'd be four or six dining chairs. The kitchen would be completely equipped. This is a remarkable thing. There were all the plates in the different sizes, all the cutlery, down to the last teaspoon. There'd be all the pots and pans and the kettles and the jugs, and it was all there, and it was all on the list, and when you moved in, it all had to be ticked off one after the other after the other. It's called a marching in inspection, and you do all this, and at the end of the day you're completely worn out, and in you go.
How would you deal with breakages during your tenure?
Yes, well, any breakages had to be replaced. I think you had an allowance. Yes, you did have a break. What was called a breakage allowance, and we also had you'd never believe it. We had a ration allowance still, and in the pre-war days, families would go down to the Neffy shop, and they would be issued on the spot with so many pounds of this and so many pounds of that, that were the rations for the week. Yeah, and that was still in force. Some little while after the war had ended, when people began looking and thinking, well, this is all a bit ridiculous. who wants a shoulder of lamb every week? Not necessarily. So that was turned into a ration allowance. You got the cash instead of the goods. And so there we were, headquarters, fighter command, organization, branch. Interesting job. I was with Johnny Ironmonger, who was a great fellow. He really was a great guy. He'd commanded a typhoon squadron during the invasion. And now he was a great rugby player. He played for the RAA, played for Fighter Command, played rugby for Fighter Command. And was a great skier and winter sporter. And in fact, he became the brakeman in the Great Britain bobsleigh team at St. Moritz. And Johnny used to go to this and come roaring down the mountainside with his bobsleigh. And Johnny hanging on the brake to make the thing stop before it went over the edge. Yeah, he's quite a character, Johnny. What do we do? Well, all sorts of things. We had a huge one wall was completely covered in the deployment, the whole of the fighter command deployment, every station, all the units, all the radar stations, everything was all up on this board, which had to be kept behind curtains, because along one side of the room was all windows with French doors leading out into a balcony, which looked out southwards. In fact, on a clear day, you could see Box Hill from Stanmore, and this had this fabulous view across there. Of course, anybody down there with a binoculars could read our deployment. Not that it was too difficult. If you had enough people on the ground to drive around, they'd soon find all the airfields and what was located on them. But things moved on. We lived very agreeable lives.
What was your role? What was your
role? I was all... Org 1B I was. Johnny Ironmonger was Org 1, and I was Org 1B, and we had another squadron leader, Dusty Miller. He was 1C, and I can't remember why. Not establishments. Anyway, he'd got some specific function. Johnny and I did the main deployment business, moving things around, laying in all the necessary organisation for whichever unit was moving from where to where.
Who would make the decision on where a unit
the deployment
was deployed to?
It would be it would be primarily air staff. The air staff was headed by. SASO, Senior Air Staff Officer, would be an Air Vice Marshal. Commander-in-Chief, of course, was an Air Marshal. And when I went there, it was Sir James Robb. He was CNC, followed by Bill Elliott, followed by Basil Embury. And for the deployment of a squadron, the air staff would say, we require two squadrons of Meteor 4s in such and such an area. And we rather fancy RAF station so-and-so. That would probably be because they slipped up and had a look, make sure it was a suitable station in every respect, that the bar was well stocked, and so on. That would then be put to org staff to come up with what was available. Now, it would depend, of course, how important this requirement was from air staff, whether it was just a whim or whether it was the only possible area from which the operation could be mounted, whatever it was going to be. And so we would look at all the airfields in that area and pick out those that were possible. And it would start off, of course, always with the length of the runway. So in those days, we had a minimum of 2,000 yards was required. So you'd pick out all the 2,000-yard airfields, then you'd pick out those which facilities there were. Obviously, it was desirable to make maximum use of the permanently built stations and for the wartime stations to be discarded if possible. And so it would be a question of negotiation. And then the air staff people would go up. We'd give them probably a short list, and they'd go up and have a look and decide which one they favoured. It may mean, if it was an extreme case, it may mean a case of moving out on an operational unit, putting it somewhere else, which we could do, of course. There were sort of plenty of airfields coming up for use. When the Americans moved out, there were airfields everywhere. Not that they went all that quickly. They hung around for quite a while, the Americans. And that was how the Air Force was run pretty well. but like most British things, by a committee.
Was there more of an overall deployment? Because I imagine with Fighter Command during the wartime period, obviously it was heavily influenced, not entirely, but heavily on the south coast of England. Was there a movement deployment, obviously as you mentioned there was a Russian threat as well, to other areas within the UK?
Very much so. Oh yes. During the war, of course, everything was in the south, or at least most was in the south, i.e. from Exeter, which I think was the most westerly Fighter Command airfield. And then right along the south coast and all the way up as far as right up to Wick. Clearly, when the war against Germany was over, there was and we weren't at that time going to fight the French as far as we could see. So all the south coast became redundant in the general sense. But a very good station, for example, like Tangmere or Westmorling or Biggin Hill, they would be retained. But as the threat moved further north, so more units would be pushed up that way. It would depend on the air staff appreciation of the scene, of course. But, yes, we certainly had more strength in the northern part of the country after the war than we did during the war. Quite a lot of units moved up the east coast in particular. And indeed, that's what my Meteor Squadron was doing. That squadron would not have been up. There would have probably been a squadron, or maybe two, at Horsham St Faith, but no more than that.